Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this program, we explore Great Britain's prehistoric standing stones, including Stonehenge, with author Fiona Robertson. When her husband Stephen was diagnosed with incurable cancer, Robertson set out on a journey that was equal parts literary, spiritual, and emotional. She was writing a book about the couple's mutual love of exploring Great Britain's megaliths, from West Penwith and Avebury to the Lake District and Orkney. The book is appropriately titled Stonelands, a journey of darkness and light through Britain's ancient places. It's a tale of profound grief, but it's equally a story about the joy of discovering and reconnecting with the standing stones, which themselves are symbols of endurance and survival over millennia, contrasted with the brevity of our human lifespans. The stones are places filled with mystery and surrounded by folklore, stories that people have passed down through generations to try and explain the existence of the stones and perhaps our own. Fiona joins us now from her home in England. Fiona Robertson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, let's get something out of the way right in the beginning. The subtitle says a lot about this book. It is a journey of darkness because, it deals with the loss of your spouse, Stephen. And I'm just wondering if you could, briefly share with us, when that happened and why you decided to write this book.
So it's now just over 3 years since my husband died, and this January will be 4 years since he was diagnosed with incurable cancer. And that kind of diagnosis was such a huge shock, and it kind of, obviously turned our lives upside down. And I wanted to sort of do something with my emotions and my thoughts. So I started writing this book after he was diagnosed and before he died, and then I just carried on writing it, really, because I wanted to write about the kind of lovely times we'd had together looking for ancient sites in the landscape. And I also wanted to write about things like, I think, things about connecting with the past and with navigating my own sense of loss, and just the fact that standing stones seem to me to be these amazing metaphors of survival and endurance. So all of this came together in the writing of the book.
Yes, and I do want to point out that in the subtitle, where it says darkness and light, and is italicized, because it does have a lot of light in this book. There is a lot of joy and love and remembrance to go along with the sorrow. So it's a very powerfully written book and incredibly well written and researched. I'm just curious, like, the research for this really is extensive. But before we get into that, briefly tell us what it's about, because for our listeners, they may not really know too much about Britain's ancient stone places.
Of course. So, in fact, when I mentioned standing stones earlier, I thought, that's not even the thing that you guys, I mean, you have sort of similar things in the US, but in Britain, these are basically megaliths, huge upright stones that were put up 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. So I'm kind of, for a long time now, I've been interested in the monuments of the Bronze Age and the Neolithic that survived in Britain. And when I was working in publishing, I commissioned a book called The Old Stones, which is a survey of Britain's 1,000 best or so Bronze Age and Neolithic sites. And when I was working on that book, I got to know a lot about these ancient places, and I guess I became a real kind of committed megalith geek at that point. And so all the while I was working on books like those and visiting sites, my husband Stephen and our kids were coming along too. So we were very much a standing stones enthusiast family.
So it was you then really that kind of was the driver with your family visiting these sites that you and Stephen got interested. Do you remember, when was the first time that you went together as a couple to one of these places?
Well, it was really soon after we met, actually. So we met in June 2003, and then a couple of months later, we had our first expedition when we went for a walk along the Ridgeway, which is this ancient path that runs through Oxfordshire and Wiltshire. And some bits of it are, probably relatively modern, but some bits are very old. And especially in Wiltshire and Oxfordshire, it runs past places like the White Horse of Uffington, which is this huge chalk figure of a horse that was carved into the hillside back in the Bronze Age. And it runs past Wayland Smithy, which is an even older, a Neolithic burial chamber. And it goes very close to Avebury, which is the most incredible site, which is a village surrounded by an ancient stone circle. So we just had the most magical time walking along the Ridgeway. We wild camped, you know, somewhere off the path. And then the next day we kind of carried on to Avebury. And it was almost like a kind of ritual that inaugurated our relationship and set the tone for what was to come in terms of seeking out these places and getting into the folklore and the legends and so on. So Stephen was very interested in ancient stuff too, but he was a big bird watcher.
I was going to say, one of the things I really enjoyed was that you're the stone enthusiast and he enjoys them too. But I felt like, you know, I was along with the two of you because I love birds. I'm not an avid birder, but I do love them. And I think they're just fascinating creatures. So I really enjoyed his, you know, his little entries, his little diary entries that you included, where he would mention the birds that he was seeing, you know, because, you know, that when you visit a place like these beautiful places in England, they're in natural wild settings for the most part, aren't they?
Exactly. So one of the joys of visiting them is that it gets you out in the countryside. And he absolutely loved birds. And the other thing that he did a lot of was climbing. So I was getting to know the rock and the different types of rock used to make the monuments, which can be quite different. So, for example, on the Isle of Lewis and Killanish, the rock's made out of Lewisian gneiss, which is Britain's oldest rock, and it's incredibly beautiful silvery rock. Or the Rollright stones in Oxfordshire are made out of a type of limestone that's quite susceptible to weathering, so they're very gnarly and characterful rock. So there's all these different types of rock. And then while I was getting to know them in ancient terms, Stephen was getting to know different types of rock as a climber, like what it was like to climb on Millstone Grit in the Peak District, for example, which is it's got these tiny little nubbles and it's quite sticky. So he would always go on about how great it was to climb that particular type of rock.
Oh, that's cool. Because I know lots of people who love to boulder and rock climb, and they do. They get to know the rocks intimately, the rock types.
Yes.
And they definitely have their favorites and the kind that, ooh, I don't like climbing on that.
Yes, exactly. And then when it works well, it's almost like a duet between the climber and the rock. And it's a wonderful thing, really.
And of course, a lot of this journey is a journey through grief. And it is a difficult thing to go through, I know personally. You have a quote in the book by C.S. Lewis that I found very moving and interesting about grief being a lot like fear. What does that mean to you now that you've kind of you've had to navigate this now for a few years? What does that fear? What did C.S. Lewis mean by that, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question because I didn't really know until I'd experienced this kind of horrible bereavement. I hadn't felt that myself, but then when I read what he'd written, it really resonated. And part of it was, with the diagnosis, I got a lot of anticipatory grief, and that emotion kind of, it just destroyed my faith in the stability of reality, and it made me realise in a really visceral way that things won't stay forever. And then for almost a year, we were living with the dread that he was going to die, and that was just such a very fearful state for us both to be in. And then after he died, I found that my life was full of fear. I was suddenly completely vulnerable to it because this faith that I'd had that everything was going to turn out okay had just completely gone. So you're missing this person and you're missing them desperately. And the grief is, you know, partly nostalgia or regret or kind of warm feelings, but it's also something really quite dark and terrifying because you're fearing what else might happen because something so bad has happened. You wonder what else might be around the corner. And then you also wonder other things like, you know, is all the happiness behind you? Is your life over? I found it a really dark place.
It's a very dark place to be in. And I've been there. And and it's interesting. I just will share this with you that for me, it kind of trying to come out of it, and you know, you do time doesn't heal wounds, like they say, but it does make them less raw. So I'll put it that way. And one of the things that I notice is, like, sometimes I'll go through the better part of a day now and not think of those things that bother me. And then I'll, you know, and then it will come to me, or somebody will mention something and bring it up, and then it, boom, it's there. But I kind of find myself noticing, oh, look at you, Dave, you made it through 8 hours today. Good for you.
Yes. I'm sorry that you're going through it yourself. It's tough, and I think it changes you just so irrevocably, and that's something else I wasn't expecting. So I guess after a while, you start living your new life. Instead of being in a place where you feel like you're at the end of life, or you're waiting for it to go back to how it was before, you accept it never will do, and you start living your new life. But without, you've still got the loss of that person always with you. And they do say, somebody put it to me that the thing about your grief doesn't diminish, but you grow around it. And I think that's very true.
That makes sense, yes. And okay, so back to your landscapes. Because for me, one of the things I found a great deal of joy reading this book is I had a vague idea that there were these megalithic sites, these Neolithic sites in the British Isles in Western Europe, that they were ancient and interesting. But I just really had no clue about them whatsoever. And this book took me inside that world. Could you just kind of give us a little Neolithic sites 101 for us Americans? You know, we've all heard about Stonehenge.
Yes.
But there's just so much more to this than that.
Of course. Well, I mean, I myself didn't realize just how much there was out there, really, until I started working on the old stones. And then I discovered, I think there are 1,000 stone circles spread across Brittany, Ireland, and Britain. And then with a large proportion of them within the UK itself. And then you've got a countless numbers of individual standing stones. And then in Britain, there's also about 300 stone rows. So there's literally thousands of these places. And some of them are in an awesome state of preservation. So you have stone circles like the main Callanish site on the Isle of Lewis, which is just stunning. These very, very tall, slender, beautiful megaliths, and in an incredible state of preservation, because that site was buried in peat for about 2,000 years, with only the very tops of the stones sticking out. Whereas in other places, the stones were taken away to be used in building and so on. That site's been preserved kind of pretty much intact. But all over the country, you know, from Orkney down to Cornwall, so many ancient sites. And then in terms of when they were built, so stone, of course, can't be dated, but you can date material remains that you find inside a burial chamber, or let's say a stone falls over, you might find something in a stone hull. So very close to London, very close to where I live, actually, only 45 minutes drive away, is a place called Caldrum Longbarrow. And that's the remains of a Neolithic burial chamber that was once inside a barrow. And it's very close to Maidstone in Kent, and it's surrounded by motorways. And it's a very modern landscape that you just wouldn't think to find something so ancient. But the remains found in that chamber have been dated to 4,000 BC. So that's 6,000 years old.
That's ancient.
So that's right. I know, it's so old. It's incredible it survived. So that's right at the start of the British Neolithic. And the Neolithic is when people started to build with stone, and they also started to do things like polish stone axes, and they became farmers. But then in terms of stone circles, there's one in Cumbria called Long Meg and her daughters, and some charcoal, hazel charcoal found inside a stone hole there has been dated to about 3,300 to 3,100 BC. So that's probably one of the earliest stone circles. And other early ones are up in Orkney. But then other stone circles, much later, so they might come from the Bronze Age, from 2000 BC. And then people were still raising standing stones right up until about 1000 BC. So you've got a range of about 3000 years from the start of the Neolithic to when they stopped putting up standing stones. So it's a huge length of time, and there's a huge range of different sites.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with author Fiona Robertson as we talk about her new book, Stonelands, A Journey of Darkness and Light Through Britain's Ancient Places. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with British author Fiona Robertson. In her new book, Stonelands, she shares the inner and outer explorations she has taken through the loss of her beloved husband Stephen to cancer and their mutual love of exploring the standing stone monuments left by the prehistoric people of Great Britain. Could you maybe do a little glossary with me on some definitions? Because some of these terms, I've heard them, but I don't really understand them deeply. Yeah. let's start with a really basic one. You know, we've all heard of Stonehenge. What is a henge exactly?
Okay, so a henge is a circular earthwork, and it has a bank and then a ditch inside that. So weirdly, Stonehenge, which gave its name to henges, is the other way around. There's a ditch and then a bank inside. So why Stonehenge is that way around, I don't know. And sometimes these earthworks have stones in them. So Avebury is one example. Stonehenge is another one. There's a famous henge called Arbelow in Derbyshire where it's got the stones, but they're all flat. And it's not clear whether they were always flat or whether they at one point were upright and fell. But then you've got henges that have never had stones in them. So near Stonehenge is a place called Woodhenge. And that is that's rings of timber circle. That's basically timber rings. Thornborough henges in Yorkshire never had any stones, or I don't think it had any timber posts either. There's various sorts of prehistoric earthworks. I think the first type are called causeways enclosures. But we're getting into technical archaeological stuff here.
Well, that's okay. It's interesting to know like what some of these terms mean. And you mentioned barrows earlier, and yes, that's not a term we tend to use here in America, but it is, you know, definitely a part of ancient Britain's landscape. Tell us what barrows are exactly.
So, well, you have mounds. I think you'd call them mounds rather than barrows, which I guess is possibly the same thing. So you can have a long barrow, a round barrow, a bowl barrow, and essentially they're mounds where they're burial mounds. So sometimes these burial mounds had stone chambers inside them. That, for example, is the one I mentioned earlier, Cauldrum Long Barrow. That was a barrow with at one end of it a chamber. And they were used for burial. And then you have other structures you've probably seen pictures of the classic dolmen, which is two upright stones and then one balanced flat on top. Three upright stones and then one on top. Now, as I'm describing, I'm thinking you might get confused with what we have at Stonehenge are the trilithons, which are the really huge structures with like two big pillars and then one flat on top. But I'm thinking of something a bit more basic, which is just like they have like the three uprights and then an absolutely enormous capstone. So you get sites like that in Ireland, and then there's a famous one in Wales called Pentre Ifan. So people used to think that they were burial chambers and that they would have been covered with earth, but they're so big. And the raised up capstone is just so massive that some archaeologists now think that they never would have been covered, and that this was, maybe no one was ever buried inside them. Maybe that particular type, the dolmen, was just a display. So different groups of people showing off their very large stones to each other.
Let's talk a bit about Stonehenge in particular, because I know that's what most of our listeners are familiar with. and it is an amazing sight. What are some of the challenges or advice you'd give to somebody who wants to come to Wiltshire to go see Stonehenge? What are some of the challenges you face? Because it's, you know, it's one of those things that's so popular, you know, you worry about people loving it to death. What are some ways you can go about visiting that and have a truly good, meaningful experience?
Well, so Stonehenge is a bit of a victim of its own success, really, because it's just so famous. It's famous all around the world. And if you come to the UK, everyone wants to come and visit Stonehenge. So it's very, very busy. They've got this visitor centre, which is incredibly informative, but it's a bit like an airport going through. It's quite expensive to go. I mean, most outstanding stones, you can just go and visit them for free, but Stonehenge is quite pricey. And you can't touch the stones if you go on a normal tour, because there's just so many people that go, they had to they had to basically fence them off. But you can't. There are ways you can experience Stonehenge close up. So one way is if you go at winter solstice or summer solstice, you're allowed in, and they have a big celebration, and lots of druids go, and lots of revelers, and people stay up to, you know, through the night to watch the sunrise, and there's lots of music and drumming and dancing and so on. That's very fun, but you won't be alone for sure if you do that, because I think 25,000 people went this summer, and I think 4,000 people are anticipated to go in next week for winter solstice.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's very popular. So the other thing you can do is you can take a private tour to watch sunrise at some other time of year. And that's probably the way of getting the more intimate experience of the stones, which I've not done that myself, but I would like to. And then my little tip is if you want to, you can walk up to the heel stone. So basically, you'll imagine, hold Stonehenge in your head. It's this amazing kind of almost classical looking monument with their trilithons, and they're shaped. They look like pillars, and they're actually joined together, some of them, in a very clever way, like with a kind of carpentry joint. So that's dressed and worked stone. But then just outside the monument is a large unshaped megalith called the Heel Stone. And the heel stone marks the alignment from the monument to midsummer sunrise. And there's an earthwork extending out of the monument called the avenue, which runs along the line of midsummer sunrise and in the other direction, midwinter sunset. So if you want, you can park your car at Woodhenge or Durrington Walls. So Woodhenge, we mentioned earlier, that's the timber circles. And then Durrington Walls is an earthwork that's the remains of the settlement where the people who built Stonehenge probably lived. And you can walk across Salisbury Plain, past this group of barrows called the New King Barrows, and then up the avenue, up this ancient earthwork, almost as far as the heel stone before you reach the fence. And you get an absolutely fantastic view of Stonehenge completely for free. And then right on the other side of the fence are all the people who've bought their tickets walking past. So it's kind of, I like it because you know you're walking along this ancient earthwork, and likely it's the way that people actually did approach Stonehenge back in the day. And the other really interesting thing about the avenue is it's probably the avenue is actually natural in origin. It's a series of chalk strips in the ground, like these kind of gullies filled with chalk. And in ancient times, they would have been visible as white stripes on the ground. And it's the fact that these white stripes are, by this amazing coincidence, aligned to the two key solar turning points of the year. So midsummer in one direction and midwinter in another is probably the reason why the stones were raised here in the first place.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful way to experience Stonehenge, to go visit some of those other interesting sites and walk along the avenue and the chalk, that beautiful chalk ridge line there, and just be out in the wild. And, you know, and then you come to the fence where all the people that bought their tickets, it's kind of like, I don't know, look at the people in Disneyland there. Isn't that great?
Exactly, yeah. You won't see the chalk stripes on the ground now. That was discovered through excavation, but As you're walking up the avenue, the public footpath follows it, so you know you're in the right place, and you may be able to glimpse traces of the banks on either side of you.
Awesome. Okay, let's have you take us on a bit of a tour of Great Britain, and I'm not going to ask you your favorite sites because that'd be really hard. There's so many, but maybe give us a general sense of, other than Stonehenge, or maybe you can place that for us too. Where are some of the really interesting places to visit that you have been to, and some maybe hit some of your favorites, starting in the south?
Sure. Well, so the farthest southwest of Britain is the Land's End Peninsula. I absolutely love it down there. So the Land's End Peninsula, also known as West Penwith, I mean, it's said to have the highest density of prehistoric sites of anywhere in Europe. And I don't know if that's correct, but it's certainly got a massively, it's just got a huge number of ancient places. So in the 9 miles of the peninsula, there are four stone circles, all of which are incredible, and likely you won't meet anyone at any of them except perhaps at the Merry Maidens, which is the most famous one. And then there's all sorts of other things down there. There's a row of holed stones. There's the Menantol holed stone, which is very well known, and people used to pass babies through it to stop them getting rickets. And there's scores of individual standing stones. So it's a really magical place, and it's full of folklore and legends and so on. And then there's other sites in Cornwall. So there's a place called Dulow Stone Circle, which is made entirely of quartz. So even in the mist, it's kind of shimmering and glistening like it's a circle of ghosts. And then Wiltshire is another favourite area of mine. So Wiltshire is where Stonehenge is. But it's also not so far away as Avebury. And Avebury, as I mentioned before, is absolutely incredible. That's the place that really got me into standing stones.
Tell us about Avebury, because most people haven't heard of it, but it's actually isn't it the largest of the structures?
Yes, it's the largest stone circle. And then within that stone circle are two further stone circles. And then within those two stone circles are yet more stones. And so what you see today is only a fraction, really, of what was once there. So the antiquarians like John Aubrey in the 17th century and William Stukeley in the 18th century recorded Avebury at the time when people were grabbing the megaliths to build the inn and their houses out of it. So another thing about Avebury is it's actually a very pretty village. And likely, many of the structures in the village were built from megaliths. So it's also got an avenue of stones stretching out from the henge into the countryside. And it's got this crazy mound called Silbury Hill, which is 40 metres high. And just so bizarre, it's in the middle of a field, rising out the field, this huge green mound, like a giant blancmange. And it's been excavated quite a few times, but through the centuries, people have dug tunnels into it. So much so that at the beginning of the 21st century, it almost collapsed. But so now you're not allowed to walk up it. You just admire it from afar. But then no one found anything inside it. There's all these rumours that a king was buried in there on horseback, and that there's treasure in there, but there's nothing that's ever been found. So that begs the question, why was it built in the first place? Who knows? So Avebury, I highly recommend. And that's not far from Stonehenge, so you could do the two at once. But then in the wider landscape around Avebury, there's some wonderful places, and almost certainly you won't meet anyone when you go there. So one is called Devil's Den, which is on Fifield Down, and that's a remains of a burial chamber. And then there's another site called the Polisher, which is one of my favourites. So the Polisher, it's a big stone just lying on the ground, but what's really amazing about it is there are the grooves and a polished dish made by people grinding and sharpening and polishing their axes 5,000 years ago. So you can run your fingers down these marble grooves and think about the people that made them all those thousands of years ago. And I find it a very evocative sight.
Yes, that reminds me of, like, even though we don't have those megalithic type structures here, you know, our culture in America, the European culture, is basically sitting on top of a more ancient cultures of the indigenous people that were here before. And I know places I can go not far from my home where there are huge rocks with, you know, grinding holes where they had been grinding acorns for thousands of years. And it's, you know, quite an astonishing thing to come upon those places and think, you know, people were here long, long before any Europeans were, and they were thriving and they were a part of this landscape.
Yes, that's so fascinating. I didn't know about that. I've seen images of the amazing petroglyphs. But yeah, it's just wonderful, isn't it, when you kind of, you just come across some evidence of the long ago people, and you just feel like you're connecting with them.
Yeah, I remember coming upon some petroglyphs in the Wind River Mountains, the Wind River Range in Wyoming. And just, they were just so mysterious and interesting looking. And I couldn't take my eyes off them. I was just riveted by them, wondering, what does this mean? What did it mean to the person that took the time to create this? And that's one of the fascinating things about these places that you're visiting, is to try to understand, like, what did these places mean to them? Why did they build them? What was their purpose? And, you know, a lot of that is just really shrouded in mystery, isn't it?
Exactly. It's fun to speculate and to try and intuit it. But one thing that you can discern is when there was some alignment to what was going on in the sky. And very often that's the solstices or the equinoxes. So I was reading about some of the alignments in America, and this one at Fajardo Butte. Do you know that one?
I do not.
It's described as a sun dagger. So it's either solstice or equinox, I can't remember. But so the petroglyph is under an overhang, and then there's a certain point in the year, a certain point in the solar cycle, the sun shines down and it bisects the petroglyph, which is a spiral, I think.
Oh, I do know this. Okay, and I didn't know the name, but now I know what you're talking about. Yes, it's in the desert southwest here.
That's right. I think I'm mispronouncing it. It's very probable I am, so apologies for that.
No, Peggy. But it's the same kind of thing. And, and you know, I remember, especially like it seemed like back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, there was a lot of archaeoastronomy work being done and lots of speculation about Stonehenge in particular, as, you know, some kind of, was it a giant calendar observatory? And what is the current thinking on that? Because there's so many people that have tried, oh, it's this gigantic astronomical observatory, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, it would seem to me that if you were really using this as a calendric device, you wouldn't need to build it out of those gigantic stones. So that, you know, there may be some truth to that, but it's hard to know.
It's impossible to know, really, isn't it? I think it's maybe there was some kind of spiritual or ritual purpose rather than a practical predictor. I think you're right. I mean, you know, surely if they wanted to use it for purely practical purposes, they could have used sticks or something. And maybe they did.
And they did. Yes. We know that people have done that all over the world. They were in tune with the sky and how it worked.
Actually, another place I was reading about is Gozek in Germany, and that is 7,000 years old. That was a timber circle, and it was aligned. So they had three gaps in the circle, and two of the gaps were aligned to the southeast and the southwest. So midwinter sunrise and midwinter sunset. So that's potentially the world's very oldest solar observatory, which is 7,000 years old. But I think there are just so many of these ancient sites that are aligned to either midsummer or midwinter, that it just seems impossible that this wasn't deliberate. I mean, it's so accurate. Like, if you think about Newgrange in Ireland, do you know about that one?
No, I don't.
That's a very special site. So Newgrange is a huge mound, and it's got a passageway into the mound. and the passageway leads into a chamber. So during when it was excavated in the 1960s, they found a stone-lined hole above the entrance, and they opened it up. And then when the team stood inside at midwinter to observe what was going to happen, because the passageway was clearly facing to the southeast, so they wanted to investigate this alignment, they noticed that a beam of light was let into the passageway and went all the way into the central chamber. And then the sun rose and the whole chamber was filled with light. And then a few minutes later, it faded again. So this phenomenon is it happens at winter solstice sunrise, and then on sunrise on the day surrounding the winter solstice. And then somehow the people of Scotland, of Orkney, built a site called Maeshowe, and that works on a similar principle, only this time it's winter solstice sunset that's letting the light into the chamber. But this kind of ancient symbolism of a beam of light entering this dark place, this place of actual, this place of burial and of actual and metaphorical darkness, and the idea of light penetrating the darkness, and the promise of the rebirth of the sun, and of perhaps of the rebirth of you know, life after death. Perhaps, I mean, I'm speculating now, but the sun itself, the return of the sun itself would have been very important to farmers, but perhaps there was a spiritual element to it too. And of course, you know, Christmas is all about the rebirth of the light, of the, you know, the birth of Jesus, light of the world. So all around the world, people honour this idea of light coming back. And so you can, it has a relevance, a sort of practical relevance in terms of living, in terms of farming, in terms of having light and warmth. And then it has a spiritual resonance. And it's very powerful. I think about this a lot, really.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Fiona Robertson. In her new book, Stonelands, A Journey of Darkness and Light Through Britain's Ancient Places, Robertson shares the personal grief from the loss of her beloved husband while finding light and meaning in exploring Great Britain's prehistoric monuments. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Fiona Robertson. She's the author of the new book, Stonelands, which takes on a very personal journey through grief and healing while exploring Great Britain's ancient standing stones. Well, you've mentioned some of these things before, and I also found this fascinating. It is fun to speculate. There's so much cool folklore that's associated with so many of these sites, like, you know, like, for example, the Nine Ladies comes to mind. There's so maidens, ladies, there's all these places. Could you pick out a couple cool ones and tell us, like, some of the interesting folklore and sure. stories that people have told through the centuries to explain how they got there?
Yes, of course. Well, there's a very common one that appears around standing stones all over the country, and that's the idea that the stones are either dancers or sports players or workers who've been turned to stone for the sin of breaking the Sabbath. And it kind of reaches its finest moment at the Merry Maidens down in Cornwall, where it seems to be embedded in the whole landscape there. So you have the Ring of Dancers, who are the Merry Maidens.
And describe for us what that is, what that looks like, the stones themselves. How big is this?
So the stones are, I think there's 19 of them, and the stones are not huge, but they're pretty stones because they're evenly shaped. So they're kind of like medium-sized stones, elegant pillars, really, on this sloping field in the very beautiful landscape of the Land's End Peninsula. So you've got the Merry Maidens are in their field, and then across the road and a little way along, you have the Pipers. And the Pipers are much taller than the Maidens. And the Pipers are said to have, as midnight struck, there was a bolt of lightning, a thunderclap. The Maidens were turned to stone, And the two pipers who'd been making the music for them ran for their lives and got as far as the field. One got further than the other. So there they stand, also turned to stone. And then you have another stone called Gunrith, who is the fiddler. He's in a different field. And then you have away, you also have the blind fiddler. You've got various other musicians and dancers all over the Land's End Peninsula. And it's all dating back to the same legend, which probably arose in the early modern period with the rise of Puritanism and Sabbatarianism, when people were discouraged from working or making music on a Sunday. So that's one.
And it seems like, just read from reading your book, it seems like everywhere you go on your journeys, there's a story. There's or
Yes.
stories, many stories that are associated, because it seems it's natural that as human beings we'll try to place our meaning on something that we don't understand.
Absolutely. I mean, we love to tell stories, really. So these stones have been standing there in the landscape for untold centuries, and I'm sure people have been telling stories about them all the time, and we're still telling stories about them now, which is great. I mean, I guess, part of the thing about archaeology is that you just don't know. So archaeologists, in addition to being very scientific, are also often quite poetic and very imaginative, because they have to come up with these amazing stories. But just to get back to some of the others, so another very common one is that the stones were giants. So in Orkney, for example, you've got the Ring of Brodgar, which is supposed to be giants who were dancing, and then when the sun came up, they were turned to stone. So giants make often actually makes a bit more sense than people, because they are often very big. And then King Arthur is another one who pops up quite a lot. Particularly in the West. So you'll have Arthur's quoit, it'll be stones that were thrown by Arthur. Or if they weren't thrown by Arthur, then they were often thrown by the devil. That's another one. So Arthur appears a lot, and the devil appears a lot. And then there's various legends that the stones commemorate battles between the Saxons and the Britons. Or the day or a Danish victory, and that, of course, is always entirely wrong, because the stones are always much, much older than that.
And it's also fascinating to me to think about the mystical aspects of these places, just the natural landscape in like Dartmoor, places like that that I've seen, photographed and filmed so many times. There's these places called tors, which, some people associate with, oh, this is where UFOs visit and stuff like that. It's just when you go out to these places, it's interesting just to kind of let your mind be open to like, okay, this is a mysterious place.
Well, the tors are pretty amazing. So they're kind of granite outcrops. And in Dartmoor, they're called the tors, but the same phenomenon in Cornwall are the cairns. So they're these fantastical stacks of rock on the horizon that are weathered into strange shapes and draw the eye from far away. And some archaeologists believe that the people that built the very early stone monuments were actually relating to the tors or the cairns in some way. And perhaps they were trying to recreate them in miniature. So, for example, the Cornish quoits, which are early burial chambers, and they're quite low, and they have these kind of huge capstones. Some people have pointed out that they do look a bit like a rock stack on the horizon, especially from a distance.
I don't remember exactly where it was from your book. I'm pretty sure I remember this story, but I found it to be fun and amusing. Was there's a place where you try to count the stones and you never quite get the right answer. You never. Where is that?
There's a few of those. So I think the one you're referring to is called the Countless Stones,
Yes.
and that's in Kent. That's part of the area, the Medway Megaliths, that's only a short drive from my house. So yes, at that particular site, the Countless Stones, the folklorist who recorded this this legend said that when he visited there sometime in the 1940s, he'd found numbers chalked on the stones, indicating that people had been quite recently going there and trying to chalk up the number and, and work it out. But then at some sites, in addition to there being a legend that the stones are countless, there's another one that says, if you do manage to count them up and get the right number, you'll die. So perhaps it's safer not to try.
Best to not do your arithmetic quite right.
Exactly, yes.
Don't do your maths there.
The Rollright stones, I remember trying. I think that's the one where it's dangerous if you get the right number. But I do remember counting it up and just never getting the same number because you can't. I mean, the Rollright stones has been a bit messed about with. So some of the stones have been broken into two or even three. Not necessarily sure. Some have been moved, some have been added. And that's actually the case with many sites. Like, it's very rare to have a pristine site. There's normally something, because it's been there for such an incredibly long time. And I guess that's part of the history of the site, really.
And Fiona, could you just comment on, you know, public access to these places and, you know, some of the issues surrounding that for Great Britain, at least?
So, you know, in general, the access in the UK is quite good. It's better than in Ireland, where the sites are on private property and actually many of them are inaccessible. But there are issues. For example, some of the ancient sites, like the Stalden Row, are on land that is owned, privately owned. And although there is access now, it may be that that access is taken away in the future. And there are other issues like the Stalden Row. In order to get to that, you now need to hike in from quite a long way. And there used to be a high-level car park where families could go, or, you know, less mobile people could go to visit the stones. And now that's not there. So where there's private ownership, there's always a worry that at some point the access might be withdrawn.
Yes, it's always that balancing act between private property ownership and their rights versus the rights of the public to go visit important places.
And there's also the issue of protecting the sites. So obviously Stonehenge, it would be impossible to give access all the time because of the sheer numbers of people who go there. But this has now become an issue at the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney and also at the main Callanish site on the Isle of Lewis. And in both cases, that's because of mass tourism via cruise ships. So they have huge numbers of people descending on the sites in these very, very remote places that don't have great infrastructure. So as a result, both of those circles are now, well, I think Callanish is going to be potentially fenced off, and certainly Ring of Brodgar often is, because the people walking on the henge is damaging the ancient earthwork.
Yeah, the old case of loving someplace to death.
Exactly.
Well, I also would think there's probably a culture of people that this is what they do, like you, the megalith hounds, if you will. They're just, that's what we do. We go sleuth out these places and visit them. One of the things I love about your book is it is a story of family. And I'm curious as to your kids, Alex and Ava, are they enjoying going out on these journeys with you now? And, you know, do you think that they'll carry on that family tradition of wanting to go find these places and explore them?
If they were in this room and you asked them the question, they would definitely say no. However, there are some promising signs. So my son is 16 now, and he recently went on a camping trip with his friends up in the Peak District.
And did he enjoy that?
He did, and it involved a lot of walking. And on one day, their lunch stop was at the Nine Ladies Stone Circle. So I was really delighted about that.
Well, they may not be as into it as you are, but as long as they're enjoying being in the outdoors. And I will say this, I've experienced this many times over the years as an educator and seeing kids grow up. Is a lot of times when they're, you know, in their teen years, they may say that and may feel that. But then when they get older, they may start to reconnect to, oh, mom used to love to come here and want to reconnect with that.
Yes, I think so. And I think, so first of all, they enjoy our walks now. I mean, I think I probably talk about standing stones a little bit too much, but they're cheerfully tolerant of it. And I think having these memories of the time with their dad, is going to be so special for them. And it's actually a huge privilege that I could write and publish a book on it, because lots of people lose a beloved family member and they don't have that opportunity. And just even just writing the book and being able to relive those experiences and spend time with him again was just such a privilege. So, and but it's amazing to have created this record for my children, really.
Has that been kind of a healing process, or allowed you to help you to grow around your grief to create this book?
It has been hugely helpful.
This book reminds me of the painting by John Constable, the famous painting of Stonehenge that he did just after the passing of his wife when he was going through terrible grief, and it's a masterpiece, just a beautiful
Oh,
piece of
wow.
art. And so I'm, I was thinking to myself, about the Constable painting and his story and his loss and this book, Stonelands, and thinking, this is your painting that you've done.
Yes.
It's a just a beautiful book. Fiona, thanks for sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just been wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks again to our guest, author Fiona Robertson. Her new book, Stonelands, A Journey of Darkness and Light Through Britain's Ancient Places, is available through most major booksellers or order them at your favorite local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.